Hi, I'm Guy Powell, and welcome to the next episode of the Backstory on Marketing and AI. If you haven't already done so, please visit prorelevant.com and sign up for all of these episodes and podcasts. I am the author of the newly released book, The Post-COVID Marketing Machine, Prepare Your Team to Win. And you can find more information on this at marketingmachine.prorelevant.com. There is so much going on in marketing today as AI and generative AI exploded onto the scene in the beginning of the year. Marketers are learning more and more about how to take advantage of this new capability and build creative solutions that really can differentiate their brands. Whether you're a small or large marketer, getting AI to work for them can be a big differentiator in the market. And today, I'm interviewing John Miller, and he is the president and CEO of ScribeWise. So before we get started, let me tell you a little bit about John. He is the visionary finder behind ScribeWise. ScribeWise is a content marketing agency dedicated to helping B2B firms grow. With a skilled team of writers, designers, and strategists, John is on a mission to make B2B marketing better. He champions the concept of courageous marketing, advocating for a shift from the bland to the bold in the business world. His passion led to the creation of Playing It Safe Sucks, a manifesto for courageous marketing. I really like that. John and his company help mid-sized B2B firms reshape their growth strategies with a trust-based relationships, all while proudly remaining SEO cynical. Welcome, John. It's so good to have you.
Thanks a million. It's great to be with you today.
Yeah, absolutely. So tell us your backstory in marketing and how you got your career going in marketing.
By mistake. You know, it's accidental tourist here. I worked in broadcasting for 12 years full-time in news and sports, so just journalism, really. If you can call broadcast anything in broadcasting journalism, I don't know if we can actually do that. But so I worked in that business, and you know, my dream, Guy, before we came on and started recording, we were talking a little bit about football. My dream was to be an NFL play-by-play announcer, and I was pretty good at it. And by the time I was like 33, I realized, you know, there's about 12 of those jobs in the world. I can be a little bit slow. So I just wasn't getting where I wanted to go. And it was frustrating, and it's a hard life, and you don't make much money. And I was working till midnight. And so I got out of it, and I got into public relations. And then it's just kind of segued into what has become ScribeWise. So back around 2010, I saw that they were calling it owned media then, which is still a phrase. No one really used the term content marketing. It was just starting to bubble up. But the idea of creating, in my mind, journalistic content, kind of reporting on your industry, you were seeing businesses start to do that. And I thought, that's the future. And I started ScribeWise because I thought companies would have an extremely hard time creating the content they needed. So that was partially right. And they have figured it out as time has gone by. So but we were kind of writers in a room at that point. And we've really expanded our offering as time has gone on to be much more strategic, to get into branding and a lot more design, because all of those things obviously play together. And so that's where we are today. I have a love-hate relationship with the term content marketing. It comes with some baggage, but that's what people would refer to us as.
Yeah, well, I like content marketing. That's for sure. So how big is ScribeWise? Tell us maybe a little bit more about that. What's your website and URL and good things
sure.
like that?
We're you would call us a boutique agency. There's 10 of us. We really don't use freelancers for anything. So a lot of times I know agencies will use freelance writers. We work very hard to hire people who are really good writers, who are intellectually curious, who get jazzed about learning and telling stories about complex industries. And I think we've done a very good job of hiring people who fit that mold. we have a couple of designers, and everybody has a strategic bent as well. So, we're helping our clients figure out their story, set their strategy, and then connect that story and the stories that fall from it to the audience. So we're channel agnostic. We don't say you just do these two things to every client. It's all very customized to make sure that we're having the conversations that build trust where our clients' customers are gathering, if that makes sense. Our URL, scribewise.com.
Yeah, fantastic. Thank you. And, it's fascinating when you have your own staff and you always think about, well, should I do this with a freelancer or your own staff? But to your point, it's that need to have folks that are intellectually curious is absolutely critical.
Yeah. And it's, we've some clients that work in really complex businesses we had never even heard of before we got hired into them, in industries we'd never heard of. So how are you going to figure that out? How are you going to ask the right questions? And one of the things I always say is that we don't have all the answers, but we do have all the questions. So a lot of times we're like that annoying five-year-old going, but why, but why, but why? And I think that serves us well.
Yeah, I remember, you're so right about the but why, but why, but why. So, I remember a client, they said, oh, we don't have this data. We don't have it. And I kept asking and asking and asking, well, if you had this, if you had this, and if you had this, turns out, of course, that they had it. And that right. Persistence, and I appreciate what you're talking about. That persistence really makes a lot of sense. So you've written a new book, Playing It Safe Sucks. The need for marketers to be more courageous at work. I remember when I wrote my first book, there was another book that came out and it called Your Marketing Sucks. And I said, that is such a good title. And so I really like the title that you've got. I think it's really good. So tell us a little bit about your new book.
Sure. Thank you. It came out of, the idea came about a year and a half ago. We were taught when everybody started talking about recession. And we're like, well, how are we going to talk to clients and prospects about, because everybody in a recession or in uncertain times, they kind of turtle up and they say, well, let's just do nothing and wait for the smoke to clear. And think about it, guy. If you were concerned about uncertain times, you might have done nothing for the last 6 or 7 years. All we've heard about for the last 6 or 7 years is uncertainty. Mm. That's the world. We can't just turn things off. So it started from that kernel. And then as you look around, you find a lot of Me Too type of content, a lot of follow the leader, a lot of trapping ourselves by saying we're following best practices, but not thinking about new ways to do things. And if we're not number one in our industry, but we try to do what the leader does, they will always be the leader. We will never catch them. And marketing's job is to make the company stand out. So, and yet all of us kind of hide in the trees, right? So, it's a short book. It's a rant and it's an exhortation to let's make a difference. Let's not do wacky things and stupid things just to get attention. We don't want to undermine because I believe trust always happens before the sale. All of marketing to me should be about building trust. So you don't want to do wacky things that is going to get attention, but people say their marketing is hysterical, but I would never work with them. That's really not what we're looking to do. We identify four pillars in the book of courageous marketing. And it's about trying to systematize as much as you can the building of a courageous marketing initiative.
Yeah, interesting. And I think you're right. I think it is so easy to play it safe. And unfortunately, in some industries, it just seems like everybody's playing it safe. And and not trying to be bold. I really like the term bold. Let's be bold. But to your point, it's got to be valuable bold. It can't just be bold and weird and wacky. It's got to be bold in a way that really engenders trust, of course, and also then adds to the brand in some way. And you're right too. I think copying the leader in the category or the leader in the market is it's not going to get you there. You have to do a lot more than that.
Yeah, and I think it's tempting to look at our media environment where hot takes rule, and everybody gets, you know, inflamed when someone says something outrageous. But that person who's the commentator, that pundit who's saying these outrageous things, you might find them entertaining, but do you trust what they're saying? Do you consider them a resource of facts? I think as we consume news, there's such pressure on journalists, and I don't need to make that about journalists, but there's such pressure on journalists and broadcasters to get attention.
Mm.
And the idea of credibility kind of goes out the window. And our marketing has to have credibility and trust go hand in hand. So let's be bold, but let's build that credibility.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So you talk about as well how important it is to generate demand before lead gen. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, first off, people get the two terms mixed up all the time, right? They use them as synonyms and they're not. Demand gen is about creating demand and really brand awareness and the idea that there is a challenge that your audience is facing. Lead gen is when you finally convince them that, you know, A, they're actually in the market. They've decided they want to solve this problem. They decided whatever they're doing isn't the right solution, whatever it might be. And to me, that's when that becomes a lead. And there is, I think, the inbound marketing machine that the playbook that everybody's been running has put pressure in the wrong spots. Obviously, we all want leads which lead to revenue, right? That's the purpose of all of this. But marketing will often get budget for something new, whether it's marketing automation, whatever. They get budget to do something. And in order to do that, they say, we will get X number of leads over the next year. And then they get the budget and they start the project and they say, oh my gosh, we got to get all those leads. So we start calling things that are not leads. And then we hand them off to sales and sales tries to connect with these leads. The leads want no part of it. Sales gets ticked off. They blame marketing. I blame marketing. I think we've done this to ourselves by rushing to call someone who downloaded an ebook a lead. Maybe they're just interested in the topic. It doesn't mean they want to talk to a salesperson. So let's focus on demand gen, which requires patience. Let's build that up because we know that the people who have some indication, who join our community, our audience, are never going to make it to the bottom of the funnel. So let them just be here because someday they might. And it's better if they have a high regard for your brand as opposed to, we've all done this, right? In fact, I downloaded something, gave my email. Everybody's terrified to give their email now. I gave my email to get a piece of content that seemed interesting. It wasn't that interesting. And it was from another marketing agency. So I'm not their customer at all. But it seemed like a piece of content. It was eh. It was actually around AI prompts. And I got 7 emails from them within the next week. Quick unsubscribe. Now I'm terrified to download anything from them. Is that the message you wanted to send? You were that aggressive in trying to call me a lead. It's like, just let me be.
Mm.
And I think that's what most buyers feel. Yeah. I always think, because I'm old, you go into the mall, you go into a clothing store. I don't know what he does these things anymore. And then the salesperson rushes over and says, can I help you? And they're like, no, man, I'm just looking. And that's how we act on the internet. So let people browse.
Yeah, exactly. And I think to your other point, though, where, you know, marketing has done it to themselves is, you know, they've generated all these leads that are really, you know, just tire kickers and or just people that are interested in your topic and just want to learn more. And they haven't really done the qualifications, so to speak, that's necessary to be able to then say, here's a lead, you know, now you guys in sales, this guy, you know, has a budget, he's got the authority, he's got the need, he's got, you know, a time frame and what have you. Handing that kind of a lead off is where marketing and sales really work together, as opposed to just handing off leads. And I must say, when I was early on, I'm guilty as charged. If I got, you know, 100,000, you know, 100 names or whatever from a trade show, man, oh, these things are valuable. There's a nugget in there somewhere. And 99 of them were not nuggets. 99 right. of them were just charcoal.
I was at a conference, a very niche industry conference, a couple of weeks ago, and I gave a talk. And I came back, and a buddy of mine said, did you get any leads? And I was like, I think I have an opportunity for some conversations, but I refuse. Even just, he's a social friend. He's not a colleague. I just didn't want to start thinking of them as leads. They're opportunity for conversation, and over the last couple of weeks, those have progressed. But I think
which is
that's
a good way to,
is part of the trade show is not a lead.
Yeah. And it's a great way to put that. It is an opportunity to have a discussion that might lead to the next level. And that makes a lot of sense. So you talk also about the SEO delusion. I've got some scars and things like that from SEO. And so, you know, you talk about you don't need more traffic, you need customers. Tell us a little bit about the SEO delusion.
The SEO delusion is a piece on our website. At scribewise.com, you go up to the stories, things we believe is one of our navigation buttons, and there's a drop down, you can find it there. The idea behind the SEO delusion is that digital marketing has become all about website traffic, and that's silly for most companies. If you're selling socks, you know, very low consideration offering, SEO makes sense then, right? That is a volume game. If you're selling an ERP system, having a bunch of people on your website really doesn't matter, right? That conversation is not happening only on your website. The inbound marketing machine to me is broken. Because for the aforementioned, people are very cynical about it. They're afraid to give their email to download something. That's kind of the main fulcrum of inbound marketing. And that plays into it. So we're driving a million people to our websites to try to get them to download something, to try to trick them into becoming a prospect or a lead or whatever. And the tail wags the dog on all of this. So we'll do anything to try to fool the Google algorithm to get people to our website. Oftentimes when we do that, we completely undermine the most important thing in a relationship, which is trust. Because they come to our website and they're attracted by a clickbaity headline that did not deliver. They get duped into something that's mediocre, whatever it might be. And most companies don't need thousands and thousands of people on their website. Most companies have 20, 40, 100 customers. They need the next 10. And you need to meet them in the real world. You need to meet them at the watering holes they gather at, whether that's trade shows, LinkedIn, any other social network, the media outlets that they consume. It doesn't all happen on your website. People really don't want to go to your website anymore. Depending on the website, obviously, but they want to be, if I'm in LinkedIn and I'm looking at content and I'm there too much, but I'm consuming thought leadership content, I don't want to click to your website. I want to stay where I'm at. So you have to acknowledge that and give up the obsession with website traffic.
Yeah. So where are you then meeting? Where are you or your customers really? Where are you? Where are they then meeting those buyers? How do you get that? Get it to where you're actually in, I guess, face to face, or at least pretty close to face to face with those prospective buyers?
In a B2B universe, it is it's mostly LinkedIn is a big part of that equation. Again, we don't automatically say we have to do LinkedIn because that's what we do, but it's usually a piece of the equation. I think it's media relations to industry media, being in those magazines or websites, being on those is important, being in the discussions. It could be a Slack channel, you know, a Slack channel for an industry. If that's where the discussion is happening, you need to be involved there. I do think that's a very ripe opportunity for B2B companies, is to create a Slack community that is not salesy, that is very thought leadership driven. The flip side of that is training people for you have to create new muscle memory for them. So that's hard. So that's a longer effort, but I think I think Slack is very much kind of a safe space. So people are less likely to feel like they're going to get spammed if they're in a Slack community. It depends. Trade shows. What's the content of the trade show that you have? Are you giving a talk? Have people consumed your blog content or your content on LinkedIn and then they run into a trade show? It doesn't all have, the whole relationship does not occur on your website. Your website is clearly a part of it at some point. For most companies, I think it's more about validation than volume. So you're validating your expertise. You're validating that you know what you're talking about. It's podcasts, right, guys?
Yeah.
Jeez, I left that one out, man.
Yeah. Yeah, that makes sense, especially in B2B, something that's high consideration. You're not going to find probably kind of the give and take and the back and forth that you need to get the answers that are very specific to what you're, the issue that you're trying to solve in a high consideration B2B marketing space. I often, when I talk to consumer and B2B marketers, consumer marketers, they really don't understand how hard B2B marketing is. It's easily 10 times more challenging because you're dealing with a very well informed consumer, because they've looked at all the competition, or at least they've looked at the top few competitors. And they know exactly what the differences are, and then it is about the emotional tie as well as also that trust that needs to be built up. So yeah, makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, if you're, I always say socks, right? If you're selling socks, like, my risk factor in buying the wrong pair of socks is pretty low. I can recover.
Yeah, you're not going to lose your job.
And they have free returns.
Yeah,
if I'm committing $100,000, $1 million, $5 million, $50 million for some huge ERP system, I have a lot on the line. I cannot screw that up. This is not a decision I make over the weekend, right?
Right.
So, to your point, you have to, there's a million little questions that prospect has, and you have to have, don't have to, ideally you have a piece of content that answers, which could be a three sentence email, right? But you have a piece of content ready to go that answers that question, that makes them comfortable, that builds trust.
Yeah, and helps to educate. I think there's also the educational piece that plays a big role in something that's complex, is why is this, those three sentences, so important to the overall solution. I think you're absolutely right. You know, you talk about, and I don't know, you kind of mentioned it early on about, you know, you have to be bold in some respects, but you have to be bold in the right way. You talk about needing to be vibrant, not vanilla. Tell us a little bit about that and how that can really unlock B2B growth.
I think it gets to having the confidence to not spew jargon, to speak plainly. It's because when we use, it's safer to use the bigger words that everybody else uses. Can you speak plainly? Can you speak kind of from your organization's heart? That's how you make that emotional connection. Even buying, you know, a technology platform, there's an emotional component to it. Even if it's like, if I screw this up, I'm going to lose my job, and that scares me. So how do we create the emotional connection that needs to happen? I think that's really the essence of breaking out of the box that everybody else is in. And it feels safe to be in that box because everybody else is in the box with us. But there's a great book that really inspired a lot of Playing It Safe Sucks called Return on Courage by a guy named Ryan Berman. And he has a statistic. His book came out in 2019, I think. And the statistic in there that blew my mind is that more than 50% of the companies that were in the Fortune 500 in the year 2000 did not exist by 2019. They were gone. Now, some merged and became something bigger, but a lot of them just disappeared. Those are the biggest companies we have. And they were, you know, they were on easy street. They were coasting. They were like, why would those companies take a chance, right? They were at the top. But playing it safe is the least safe thing you can do.
Yeah. Yeah. Well,
they disappeared.
Yeah.
It's
insane. Absolutely. I hate to go off track here, but I have a slight digression. I used to be a B2B marketer, and I was VP of marketing for this company, and the president, he was asked to give a speech at one of the trade shows, and I don't remember which one it was. And so, you know, I go there and he's talking kind of off the cuff. And you talked about, you know, industry jargon. And now I had been in the industry for quite a while, so I was very comfortable with all of the jargon and you know how it is. You kind of fall into a rut. You're in that box that you were talking about. Well, he had also been in the industry for a while, but he hadn't really given too many speeches. So he was making up jargon. He was making up jargon. He'd call it you got to be careful about the ABC and the QRM and the whatever. And I'm listening to this. What is he talking about? Well, the funny part is, and then I asked him, I says, well, you know, you used a couple of terms I'd never heard before. What are they? And he says, well, I totally made them up. And I had to laugh. And he said, you know, he got some interviews afterwards, and the press that were interviewing him didn't ask what they all meant because they were afraid that they didn't want to be found out that they didn't know.
Right. Holy smokes. That's crazy. Yeah,
so one way to stand out is just make up your own jargon, whether it makes sense or not.
we see that here in American society, right? You make stuff up, you get attention. So,
yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. But I think, though, to your point, you know, you can be bold and you can be vibrant and certainly not vanilla. Vanilla, unfortunately, in today's, you know, times, just doesn't get there. If you've got really good creative that gets your message across, you know, getting that attention is critical, but you have to, in the same way, you have to get that message across in a way that's meaningful for your brand. And I think that, you know, from what you're talking about, I think that makes a whole lot of sense.
And I mean, this is not news, right? But we have to consider we live in a way more competitive world because our clients can buy from us. They can buy from someone on the West Coast. They can buy from someone in India or wherever. Like, the competition that once upon a time was, we're in Philadelphia. The competition was mostly local agencies.
Mm.
So you had 30 competitors or whatever it was. Now you have 30,000 competitors, maybe. You better be able to stand out. It's a big, mushy world.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and in your space, providing content and written, you now have a huge new competitor with which is AI.
Right.
And so tell me a little bit about how you might be using it, how you might not be using it, how you see it in, impacting your business.
About a year ago, we're recording this in November. I'm not sure where you're going to, when it airs, but I was sitting on my couch. I was watching a basketball game and I went on Twitter because I do that during basketball games. And everything was not about the game I was watching. It was about ChatGPT. So I was sitting on my phone and I opened up ChatGPT and I created an account. And then I gave it a prompt to write a blog post about a client of ours in the insider threat management space. And I had a C minus blog post, all of that within 8 minutes while watching a basketball game. And I said, oh crap, we're going to go out of business. And then, but we're not, but as time went by, we started using it. We started talking about it a lot. We started brainstorming with it. Sometimes we would try to write a first draft. And our view was that it really wasn't there yet. You heard about it makes stuff up. We work with a number of healthcare systems as well. That's kind of the B2C piece of our business. We were terrified to use it for healthcare clients because if you give bad health advice,
that's
not good. And it's also, this has been updated, but it was pulling from information that was a couple of years old. But we use it, I would say we use it occasionally for a first draft or to help us work out an idea. It's great for brainstorming and coming up with ideas. And the one thing we did do, we've done a number of things, written a couple of blog posts about it, but we do have something on our website about, and it's completely dated now because it was from February of 2023. I set out to write an ebook about how to go about using ChatGPT to create your content. I put in 8 or 9 prompts. I had 3,000 words. I ended up using virtually none of those words, but I had all of, like, it got rid of that blank page syndrome.
Mm.
And by 4:30 that afternoon, the ebook was done.
Mm.
That's a month-long project, typically.
Yeah.
I've joked with people. I've never done cocaine, but I bet this is what it feels like. Because I was like, wow, this is amazing. And it was so powerful. I do think we've kind of entered into the trough of disillusionment with ChatGPT. I think people are kind of down on it, maybe because our expectations have risen a little bit. And it gives you very mediocre content.
Mm. But I think, though, to your point and to your example on the ebook, it is a great starter. I think it really helps you to narrow down, you know, what you're trying to write about, possibly give you at least a sample outline of what you're going to say. And then, you know, it's up to you to, you know, develop the content and really put some value with it. It's not clear to me exactly how it works, but it seems like in everything that I've read, it's really, when you put in a prompt, it's kind of saying, what is the next best word after the prompt? And then once you have that next best one, then what's the next best one? or the one that follows that, what's the next following word? What's the next best following word? And then it goes along like that. And so it's very dependent upon your prompt. And then it's also very dependent upon what it can find out there. And yes. I don't think it's getting, like, if you were going to write a very technical paper, it's not getting behind the paywalls, I don't believe. And so if there are companies that have, you know, really good high value content behind a paywall, it's not going to see that. And so you're not going to get that really detailed look, even though if it had access to it, it could, you know, you could use that. And then I think it would probably be significantly better.
Right.
And then I think the other challenge is too, when you're writing something that's also found on Wikipedia and it's a little bit of a controversial kind of a topic, then it also writes about both sides and you don't even know that it's writing necessarily about both sides, unless you happen to know the topic and then you go, well, that's definitely wrong or that's definitely right. And it has some challenges yet. And I don't know. It'll be interesting to see how it progresses over the next couple of years, but certainly as a seed starter, just like you did, I think it really has some value and gets you running a whole lot faster than you might otherwise.
Yeah, it's a productivity enhancer, right? But I do think it'll be interesting. It'll be scary if it can kind of grasp the humanity and bring that into content, because the best content to me does have an emotional component.
Mm.
Well, everything AI writes looks like a high school term paper.
Mm.
It's very formulaic.
Grammar is excellent. The grammar is usually right. Excellent. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. Which not all of us do.
Guilty as charged.
Yeah. So it's a good starting point to your point, but it will become, if it can kind of mimic humanity in content, that will be a huge breakthrough. That does start to get terrifying though too, right?
Like, it
becomes the Matrix or something.
Yeah. Well, or it becomes the Star Trek Data when he gets the emotion chip put in. And
right. And the other thing that is interesting, and someone posted this on LinkedIn, I'm like, that's a very good point, is it cannot today get to the level of detail that a good writer who asks smart questions can get to. Sometimes that's a personal experience. That's what makes content come to life often. And AI doesn't know those things today.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
But you know, it's artificial intelligence. It learns, it will get better.
Yeah. And I think, and to your point, that is the scary part. So one last question. And in this relatively dynamic world that we find ourselves, and whether you look even macroeconomically or just in marketing, what advice would you give an up and coming marketer, somebody that's wants to enter or has just entered the marketing space?
I think a couple of things, if I can. I would say, I just heard this last night, and this was portrayed to me as advice from a father to a son who were in disagreement. And the father said to the son, if you want a job, work from home. If you want a career, go to the office, which I thought was pretty interesting. So I know all of the technology around us has served the purpose of making things easier. That's kind of the underlying promise of technology, is to make our lives easier. And we shouldn't always do the easy things. You know, I mean, it's easier if I don't go to the gym, but that's not good for my health. And I think that attitude is disappearing a little bit. And a job is fine, but if you want a career, it depends on what you want out of life. And then the other thing I would say is embrace all these tools that are emerging, but don't rely completely upon them, which is kind of the same, the other side of the coin, right? Which is you have to learn how to do these things. New things come along every day. The things that you and I talk about today will not be true in 6 months. So you have to always be learning, but you also have to have a little bit of skepticism about every new thing that comes along. And I think that's hard to do when you're just starting your career.
And actually, it's interesting with even with AI and ChatGPT, generative AI, the new, and I don't know if it's a job yet or if it's a specialty yet, but the concept of prompt engineering and how to write the best prompts to get what you really want out of your AI is definitely a valuable, is going to be very valuable. Because I think if you, and it has to do, I think, with a little bit of, you know, that intellectual curiosity, as well as how can I write the right kind of prompt to really get what I want to get to, whether I'm going to use the result or not directly or indirectly as a seed for my own writing and my own content, but getting that prompt absolutely right is, I think there's a, I think there's some interesting new, new skills that we're all going to have to learn to really be able to take advantage of these new tools that are out there.
I think that's right. I think, and higher education has gotten away a little bit from teaching people how to think, and we just teach them skills that we think they need. But if they know how to think, it's like teaching a man to fish type of thing. If they know how to think, if any of us know how to think, then we can figure out how to attack a problem. So, and that's the same type of thing. It's get really good at asking questions in different ways.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, John, we kind of have to close off. I could talk to you for a long time. I think there's, you know, there's a lot of bold and interesting stuff that we can all learn. But in any case, thank you so much. And thank you for participating. And remind us once again, how can our followers reach you and learn more about you and your company?
Yeah, the best thing to go is we'll create a page on our website specifically for your audience, Guy. So scribewise.com/backstory on marketing. And we'll have, that's the best way to get in touch with us and follow us and have a conversation.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, this was a conversation. So maybe at some point here, we'll be doing business together. You never know.
That's great.
Absolutely. Well, so to my audience, John, thank you so much. But to my audience, please stay tuned for many other videos in this series of the Backstory on Marketing and AI. And please visit marketingmachine.prorelevant.com to download the first chapter of my book and other excerpts. John, thank you so much. Really appreciate it.
Thanks, Guy. Great talking to you.
You too.